Thanks very much, Stephen, for the invitation to be here to take part in ASIC's summer school. What I'd like to do is to talk about, in the light of the crisis, what were the key lessons, what do we need to do after the crisis, who's doing it, and what are some of the issues which arise from that, particularly for Australia. So to begin, what were the lessons that we took from the crisis and what needed to be done afterwards? Well, banks needed more capital, obviously. They needed higher quality capital. They needed more attention to management of liquidity risk. There was a need to address various misaligned incentives, be that in the originate and distribute model for selling mortgages, be it in remuneration, be it in credit rating agencies' performance, etc. There was a need to think more about interconnectedness between institutions and markets. And I suppose the other comment, as I saw the chairman of ASIC saying earlier today, is that some of the problems at least originated from outside the regulated sphere. So the question of the regulatory boundary or regulatory perimeter, as it's now called, is also on the table. So those sorts of things needed to be addressed. Who's involved in doing this? Well, the G20 took a very high-level leadership role here. The G20 does many things, actually, but at a critical moment, the G20 leaders met for the first time. Up until then, it hadn't been, the G20 had not met at a leaders' level, and they met at a critical moment and made some announcements and took some decisions that I think were quite instrumental in containing the rapid deterioration in economic and financial conditions that we were seeing. So the G20 took a bigger role. The standard-setting bodies expanded and restructured their membership. The Basel Committee, CPSS, the FSB itself. Actually, the FSB was actually renamed a couple of years ago, but the Financial Stability Forum, the predecessor body, had existed for a decade before that, but it was restructured, expanded, and renamed in order to sharpen its focus. It's now quite a big group, and in fact, there are about 75 people at the table in the plenary meeting of the FSB, so quite an expansion there, and similar things have happened in some of the other bodies. How does all this fit together? And I think this is quite an important question. The G20 certainly takes high-level decisions, but the G20 leaders are not technicians, so they are taking their decisions and calling for work on the basis of advice, obviously, coming from the people at the more technical level. The standard-setting bodies and the FSB then have to work out how you actually implement in practice the high-level objectives the G20 are giving us. Now, I think one of the difficult challenges that the FSB and the standard-setting bodies face is that we have multiple work streams. The number of subgroups in FSB has grown greatly. I cannot actually count them. I can't keep up with all of them, actually. There's multiple work streams. There are multiple standard-setting bodies that have an interest in some of the pieces of work. And there's a very compressed timetable. So if you think about the gap between Basel I, which was sometime in the 80s, to Basel II, which really didn't come in until 2007 or 2008, and some countries never even got to bring it in before we started about talking about Basel III. So there was a kind of a 20-year gap. Basel III has been designed and committed towards implementation in the space of 18 months or 2 years. There was no choice but to try to do that, but a very large, very complex work program with multiple agencies involved and a compressed timetable does increase the risk of missteps and unintended consequences. So I think in working through the implementation of all these things, that actually is an important point to keep in mind. The main components of this reform, we all know what they are in the banking sphere: higher capital standards, changes to definition of capital to make it to ensure that the capital is of higher quality. There are liquidity standards. There are attempts to address cyclical changes in risk appetite in the financial sector using countercyclical regulatory devices and so on. So that's all on a track that's to be brought in, I think it's 2019, before Basel III is fully implemented globally, though a number of countries, of which we are one, are moving a little bit quicker than the minimum standard set out by the Basel Committee. Another key issue is the question of too big to fail. Now, the backdrop to this, of course, is that the governments of the US, the UK, Germany, one or two other countries have at a particular moment ended up the proud owner of one or more larger banks because those institutions suffered potential capital shortfall and they were regarded as sufficiently systemic in scope and size that allowing a failure was not really an option. So we had this too big to fail problem. That is an issue that the FSB has been grappling with for really since not very long after the immediate crisis was contained. It's getting very dark in here. Have I said something? Not sure, but that is an issue with which we've been grappling. There has been agreement now on a set of arrangements for capital surcharges, resolution planning, and more intense supervision for institutions which are so-called G-SIFIs, that is globally systemically important. And there's a published list of who they are. And there's a set of capital standard metrics and so on to go with that group. That is more or less, I think, generally settled now. And the next phase of this process is to design a counterpart structure for institutions which are systemic domestically but not globally. And we can expect that the major institutions in our country, and the same will be true for Canada, will be captured in some way in that framework. And that is one of the chief work program items for the FSB this year. So that's too big to fail. Another work stream is OTC derivatives, which is perhaps closer to some of ASIC's core responsibilities. And the general notion here is that if we could standardise some of these things, if we could have them centrally cleared through a robust architecture, then we have ways of handling failures of particular institutions in a fashion that is less disruptive to the system as a whole. The risk there, of course, is that in centralising these clearing and settlement arrangements, you in fact, if you're not careful, create a single point of failure. So along with pressure to centralise this clearing arrangements comes the need to think about how to supervise the institutions, the central counterparties themselves, which will carry out this work, so that they are more robust, and so that should there be a failure there, that adequate resources can be made available to handle that. That is another work stream that is ongoing. And then the other one to mention briefly is so-called shadow banking, and this is the point that at least some of the institutions which created the problems were at that time anyway outside the regulatory net. And as we increase, and I think it's true to say, as you did, Stephen, that there's a more muscular, that's a good description, certainly more intrusive regulatory approach that I think was inevitable, really, in response to the crisis, that will focus on those inside the net. But we don't want that phenomenon to then prompt all the risk-taking activity to migrate to somewhere outside the net that then could grow, if it was unconstrained, large enough and given enough time, create another problem down the track. So how do we think about those institutions? And that's another ongoing work stream. It's less important for Australia probably because the things that we would describe as shadow banking here would be much smaller than would be the case in some of the major jurisdictions. Now, what are the issues for Australia arising from all of this regulatory reform? Well, there's Basel III implementation. That's really in APRA's court, and they are in the process. They've released some draft standards. They're in the process of consulting and refining those. And I really have no more to say about that because that's their prerogative. I think in the OTC derivatives sphere, this is an issue which is quite important for Australia. There is a reasonable chance that left to itself, the international system combined with a strong regulatory push globally for central clearing, we'll see most of this clearing done in a few major central counterparties located in major jurisdictions. Now, that's fine, but arguably for institutions like the ones we have, that could actually see a concentration of their exposures to the sponsor organisations through whom they clear in those institutions. So we've actually increased exposure to that major dozen or so institutions through that mechanism. You can easily get banks from everyone other than the very largest jurisdictions being treated as second-class citizens, having to clear via the major 13 global players. So issues of equality of access, reasonable terms, and so on, they're very important. So all these things are quite critical, actually, for us. And what we need to do, I think, is to be cognizant of the possibility that well-meaning reforms pushed through by the major jurisdictions that will certainly improve their situation can be, if they're not handled well, something of a mixed blessing for us. So what we've been doing, and actually the Bank of Canada has been very active in the OTC derivative space in particular, the Canadian authorities generally there, and they, I think, and it's largely due to their leadership that there is now a work program item in the FSB about setting up appropriate safeguards for jurisdictions that are not Europe and the US in terms of access and usage of central counterparties and so on. So I think that's actually, in one way, something of a model for Australia. We have to be present at these discussions, which is why being on the FSB is important. We have to understand the very real case for the reforms that are being proposed. But we also have to understand how the interests of other jurisdictions could be adversely affected if these things are not implemented well, and we have to combine with other like-minded jurisdictions to try to work to ensure, so far as we can, a sensible approach to all of this. So that, I guess, really, Stephen, is what I wanted to say. Just to emphasise again, there's a great deal underway. A lot of the focus, as you say, has been in the banking sphere, but that is generalising as time goes by to other areas of capital markets. There's also a parallel stream in insurance, which also there's Basel III and there's Solvency II, and these things all bear very close watching. And there's a great deal of work being done under the IOSCO part of FSB, which of course you guys are very much involved in. So there's a lot happening. It's important that these reforms do get implemented, but it's important they get implemented in a sensible fashion. And I think our task is to do what we can to lend our perspective and work with other like countries to ensure as much as we can that the implementation actually does deliver globally the greater stability that's been promised. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
I just want to raise one question and really get a reaction from both Maureen and Glenn. I think the key theme that I've been taking out of this is we're at a stage where we're moving toward implementation. We have a range of options, a range of factors and circumstances that are influencing what we do. How do we move toward harmonisation and more closely toward harmonisation? And do we really need to get to the point of harmonisation? What I found interesting about Jennifer's model or choices was the existence of three ways of doing it. Question is, with the first of those, which is the experiment that we're currently going through, how can the institutions like the Financial Stability Board and IOSCO effectively operate to deal with some of the issues that Jennifer raised? I think in our region, the second of the options, the multilateral meta-institution option, is probably not at this stage feasible. And the third, as Jennifer outlined, is a space that we've gone to. So my question to others on the panel, and Jennifer, if you want to add to this as well, is how do we make the institutions and organisations that we currently have at an international level more effective to address some of the concerns and the risks that we see. And also, Glenn and Maureen, feel free to add any other comments you might want to make based on what we've discussed in the last hour or so. So maybe, Glenn, if I could hand over to you.
Well, Stephen, I'm not sure that I have a complete answer to the question. I would suggest that actually we can do a little bit of both. That would be my first point. There is a certain degree of capacity for bilateral recognition that is open to us in specific cases. A case in point would be certainly under the part of clearing and settlement that is overseen by the RBA. We can in principle license foreign operators to operate here under a foreign license on the provision that their home regulator is sufficiently equivalent, as I think the technical term, and then we have to assess whether they are or not. But in specific instances like that, there can be some use of the principle of bilateral recognition. I don't actually see that as mutually exclusive with the first of Jennifer's models, the meta-level harmonisation, I think she calls it. I think actually the more we can have at least a degree of harmonisation of the overall approach globally, the more likely it is we're going to find bilateral instances where mutual recognition will be easy, and the two things would I suspect reasonably easily coexist. In terms of how to maximise the chances of the high level harmonisation working, it's a very complex animal. You know, as I said earlier, we've got 75, maybe 80 people around the table at the FSB plenary. There's an inner steering group of the FSB, which is now about to be about 40 people itself. You've got many jurisdictions, multiple agencies within each jurisdiction in the case of the major countries taking part. It's a complex animal. But I think we need to keep our mind at least on two important principles that I would outline. Firstly, the relationship between the FSB itself and the standard-setting bodies, all of which, of course, pre-existed the FSB. You know, the Basel Committee's been around since the early 70s, the mid-70s. The FSB is a much later construction. And there's a certain tension, shall we say, a certain jockeying maybe for authority between the two. I think we need to manage those relationships between the FSB as a kind of a clearinghouse of ideas, a way of coordinating work streams that cover multiple standard setters, lest they start to conflict, and a way of sorting those things out. But in my view, at least, I don't think the FSB should be dictating to the standard setting bodies. It should be facilitating them. So that relationship's important. And the second thing I would say is that it's important that the FSB not only be structured to be overtly global in its representation, which it is now, but it actually has to work that way as well. And I think that is difficult to do because the G7, you know, they're used to working with each other all the time, and even amongst that group there's frequently pretty strong disagreements because, you know, the North Americans and the Europeans on some issues are fundamentally not on the same philosophy. When you add to that another 20 countries or so, it gets more complex. So in that sense, it's a work in progress, but it's a very important work and one that we need to make sure does keep progressing, and that I think will take time. But unless it does really genuinely work globally, and that is to say, a full hearing for the emerging world, for the Canadas, Australias, Singapores, Hong Kongs, South Africa, these other countries, unless it does genuinely work globally, then we can't really achieve this meta-level harmonisation that Jennifer talks about, bearing in mind that not only is the centre of gravity of global GDP very quickly shifting towards Asia, so will, in very short order, I think, and faster than people appreciate, so will the weight of finance. Mm. And these people, you know, they're going to need to be heard, and these global bodies really do genuinely have to be global. I think the Americans will always do what they want, more or less. The Europeans are big enough to do that too. Frankly, I think so will the Chinese also do that in the future. And the rest of us need to work through these global bodies to do what we can to keep them not on too different a set of pages, so that we can kind of fit in. So I think it's a difficult task, but it's one we have no choice but to try to bring off as best we can.
Glenda, before I go on to Maureen, One of the challenges that we have in IOSCO is developing a regional voice as well, and using that regional voice to greater effect in creating the sorts of balances that that we need. Are there opportunities for that also in the FSB in creating that that sense of yes, we do matter?
I think there is, and I think we have had a couple of instances where one or more of the regional partners that we work with, not just in the FSB but in other fora, where we've had a common view about something and we've been able to sign up to some sort of joint statement or letter that has, at least at the margin, had some influence, and it's important that we do that. And I think it's imperative to encourage our Asian colleagues to speak up. A phenomenon we often find is that you find a number of people who privately agree with you but don't say it in the meeting. It's critical to make sure that we all actually do say it in the forum where it can be recorded and influence the outcome. And that, I think, there's an opportunity for Australia there on occasion to take a sort of a leadership and coordinating role, which we've done once or twice. And I think that is a very effective way of contributing.
Thank you.
Mr. Stevens, Damien Smith from Seven News. I'll try valiantly to keep my question on topic. The Australian banks have blamed offshore developments for increasing their funding costs, yet they have increased interest rates since your board last met and left the cash rate unchanged. You'll probably be aware of the remarks of the head of Asian Research for Société Générale, who said that these upward movements are simply profiteering, or perhaps taking advantage of an onshore opportunity. Do you agree with him? Or are Australian banks, by doing this, simply building resilience in turbulent times? Is that relevant?
Well, the issue of funding costs was covered in the minutes today, which I can read out if you want to take the time. But I think the facts are that since the middle of last year, the cash rate's come down 50 points, and funding costs, the cost of funding the books, hasn't come down quite that much. And that's what everybody's aggravated about, but that is a fact. And so relative to the rate we set, the funding costs have gone up a little bit because they haven't fallen as much as the cash rate. And that is a fact, and the banks have responded to that in a way that you would expect they would, I think.
Governor Stevens talked about the importance of the FSB and the G20. Maureen Jensen about the implementation of rules, and Jennifer Hill about harmonization of rules altogether. So seeing the G20 issuing recommendations all over, I have two questions. So first question would be, how can the FSB make sure that G20 recommendations, and I grab one example, it's the regulation and supervision of credit rating agencies. How can the FSB make sure that that G20 recommendations get implemented on time? I think it should be implemented by G20 members by the end of 2010. And as we have heard, many G20 members are still in the process of getting their regime up. And second, how can we make sure that the rules are harmonized on a global level?
How do we make sure they're internationally consistent? Well, that's what the FSB is all about, and that's why when these projects run late, which can happen, it's because it's hard to craft something that everybody can agree in detail is the way forward. How do you make sure they're implemented? I think the main device is going to be that there is peer review in the FSB. There are peer reviews on topics. There are FSAPs. In fact, we are to complete an FSAP this year again, last one being in 2006. So I think the main device for ensuring that implementation occurs is the process of peer review, and I think certainly among the major jurisdictions, if there's a feeling that one or other is not quite implementing everything, the other jurisdictions, I'm sure, are very quick to point that out. So peer pressure really will be, I think, the main device.
My final question was, again, that sort of interplay between the greater complexity at the international regulatory level and at national level, because I wonder to what extent the international developments may actually drive national regulatory schemes to become simpler. Australia, we talked about it in the opening session yesterday, in a way we were very lucky because the Wallace Report in 1997 was looking at all those issues in advance. It was saying markets are becoming more global. How can we have a regulatory system that reflects what is occurring? But then, you know, you look at the US system, 115 regulators, all derived from the 1930s, haven't been giving it much thought since the 1930s. And I just wonder to what extent what's happening at the international level may drive clearer and simpler regulatory systems at a national level, and that's something Canada's also dealing with at the moment.
Well, I think it is an interesting question. My guess is that, it's obvious, isn't it, the pressure to change national regulatory systems is greatest in the countries that had the biggest problems. I think what we see there is a certain degree of shifting of responsibilities. The number of regulators went down by one. What? Which actually was not a perhaps an entirely huge reform. In the UK, bank supervision is going back to the central bank. Mm-hmm. I'm not making a play for that, but that similar things have happened in one or two other cases. So you get shifts in regulatory structure where you've had a problem because something must be done, right? And a change in the structure of regulation is one thing you could think of to do. Another thing that's happened is that I think there's more development now of a kind of umbrella structure for overall financial stability. So the Americans have FSOC, I think it's called. There's a counterpart thing in Europe that's going to sit over the top of the whole regulatory structure. We have something called the Council of Financial Regulators, which the Bank, Treasury, ASIC and APRA are on, and we've had that all along. So in a sense we have at least a form of that umbrella body. So I think you see that as well. That could lead to more simplification, or conceivably it could lead to more complexity. I think it will just depend on the country concerned. I think the key question is, will it really make a difference the next time there's a crisis? That, I think, we all hope so, but really the test will be when the time comes, and I don't think we can know until then.